You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts.
Are you in the nursery sector? Or maybe you're in a sector of the industry that depends on the nursery sector, and you'd like a peek into what's going on there, including production, wholesale, and retail nurseries. Bruce Durant has been in the game for over 40 years, including time spent in the landscape and nursery sectors, who's now working in sales at this episode's sponsor, Arborgreen. He's well established within the industry, and you might recognise him from his time at Shawgrow Treemax, before their merger with Arborgreen. In this episode, we'll chat about the challenges and opportunities for professionals within this sector, how to prevent root girdling, which leads to failure for trees to properly establish once they're installed in the landscape, and we find out what the most sought-after flower colour is. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
It's going to be a cracking episode, mate. We've got some great questions down here. So I guess, what are some of the common challenges faced by nurseries when it comes to growing trees on a commercial scale?
I think all nurseries have challenges, but on a commercial scale, ultimately I think it's the understanding the value of plants, because I think a lot of nurseries undervalue that, you know, because over the years, prices, there's been a lot of price increases in the ingredients to grow a plant, but the price of plants themselves, I don't think has substantially jumped for 10, 15 years. And I'm sure 15 years ago, I could go to from a wholesale point of view and go out and buy a plant for about $6. And I don't think it's much more than that now. So, I often think that there's an undervalue of what a plant is actually worth. So that's probably the big one. Other challenges would be, you know, from a logistical point of view, is staffing. You know, there have been staff shortages throughout the nursery industry over the last few years. Hopefully it's improving recently, but certainly through COVID and beyond, they were struggling to get staff. Every nursery that I've dealt with was always saying, do you know anyone? Do you know anyone that wants a job? So it's staffing, it's attracting new apprentices to the industry. You know, I think a lot of the I'm going to sound old here, but a lot of the newer generation of young, you know, I'll say kids, but young adults, you know, they think they're going to jump in and get a million-dollar job, you know, in front of a computer. But the hort industry is fantastic. It's just such a satisfying industry to be part of. I'm an ex-nurseryman or an ex-landscape gardener that moved into a nursery and became a nursery manager, but then, you know, then went to the dark side and became a rep. And, but it's a great industry to be a part of, and I would encourage anyone to give it a crack. Other challenges would be the continuity of supply chain from my point of view of materials. Again, hit by COVID, that's things like bamboo. You know, we used to be able to order a container of bamboo from China and quite confidently say to a customer, if I don't have it in stock, but I should have it in about 6 to 8 weeks' time, and we would order a container, shipping container to arrive from China. That has blown out since COVID, and it's getting better now, but it's still horrific. It is, probably the worst case scenario, something that was ordered, the container arrived 15 months later.
Wow.
And logistically, it's a nightmare to work around that. And so there has been a time the nursery industry has been screaming for specific materials, and that it's not just bamboo. But, the same with a lot of the fertilizers come from Holland or and other places, and it was the same situation. Herbicides are the same. A lot of the raw ingredients of herbicides come from overseas, China, and all of those materials over the last few years, it's been diabolical to have them here. And for a nursery that that schedules, you know, when they pot up, and they often specifically need different size steaks. It's been a nightmare. The same with us. The other side of our business is the tree guard erosion control side of the business, but the stock standard size bamboo for a tree guard is a 75 centimeter 10 to 12, and that's something we would normally have hundreds of thousands of. And there was a point there where we were down to the last few thousand, wow. just not available. And that was It's not because they weren't ordered, it's because they were ordered and they hadn't arrived.
And how do you help that?
Well, you don't have any fingernails left. You come up with some alternatives, and that supply, especially since COVID, has been horrific to try and manage. Mm. And we're not alone. That's all other businesses supplying to, and not just in the nursery industry, but to other industries as well. It did have a huge impact. Other common challenges would be, you know, from a general nursery point of view as well, would be water supply and having, you know, quality of water. Lack of pre-emergent herbicides, because the raw ingredient for what was the stock standard for rout and dismiss, which is is one that's been around for a long, long time, you know, probably 20 years, I guess, within the nursery industry, but the raw materials behind the scene are no longer available. So the rout is no longer available. So that's left a huge gap or window within the industry to seek alternatives. They're coming. They're all scrambling to come up with alternatives, different companies, and they are coming. But at the moment, there's just a lack thereof. Ultimately challenges. Plants never take a holiday. You know, you have to be open and working 365 days of the year. It can sometimes be a challenge as well.
Absolutely.
Probably missed half a dozen, but propagation windows. You know, the same sort of situation is. I know of a nursery that was impacted again through COVID recently. Because propagation can only occur when the plants are ready. And so if you have your staff off through COVID, it can have a huge impact on the business, because you need skilled staff to be able to propagate. And I'm probably more referring to cuttings. And when you miss that window, you miss it. You know, the window, you can't just say, I'm going to propagate now. You actually have to propagate when the plants are ready to be propagated. So,
and if you don't have the materials there, well, what do you do? You have to innovate.
That's right. That's right. Mm.
So maybe you use something a bit too big for the tree and you have to spend a little bit more on stakes that are bigger, or maybe you have to – maybe you've got some bamboo in your backyard that you can chop down or something like that.
Well, people did look for it from a bamboo point of view. Often they went up a size or down a size, or we always try to accommodate that. Some went hardwood stakes, but even the issue of hardwood stakes, there was a huge shortage because the imported timber wasn't available for the same reasons that we just stated before. The building industry couldn't get all the imported timber. So they turned around then to the Australian industry and purchased more through the Australian timber mills. So that made them busier. They were getting they were probably getting better value for money for doing commercial timber rather than hardwood stakes, which is a lesser value item. So that all had an impact as well on the supply of even hardwood stakes. We did look at we did a lot of research at the time. We did look at recycled plastic stakes, but sadly just not viable in cost for the industry at this stage. Fiberglass, some nurseries are using fiberglass stakes in the initial stages anyway, not so much for selling with fiberglass, but so there's a lot of people trying different things. I guess we were innovative when there was a shortage of hardwood stakes. We were able to get a thicker bamboo, a 75 centimetre, 18 to 20 mil, and that was a direct sort of alternative to using a hardwood stake, and that that worked quite well. Mm-hmm. So, no, very pleased with that as an innovation.
Yeah, very cool. So as long as we can get those trees out, businesses can keep, you know, supplying their customers, keep making people happy so that people don't drop off.
Indeed.
Mm.
Absolutely.
So, Bruce, one of the biggest problems as a maintenance gardener, because I actually come from the opposite end to you. So I'm the guy who actually looks after the plants 10 years after you grew them and, you know, you've long since forgotten about them. But one of the biggest things I've seen in the maintenance gardening side is that roots are often pot-bound, and then when we put them into the ground, they're pretty much stuffed. They might have a good 10 years in them or something, and then they're just going to drop off because the roots can never really get out and get going. And this is really a problem that can be solved at the nursery stage. So can you tell us about, you know, traditional pots versus air pots?
Ultimately, the you've got to buy quality. Yeah, I'm a big believer in that. Quality, cheap isn't just cheap. Cheap is, you can buy a cheap plant, but cheap equals cheap. So, mm-hmm. yeah, regardless of what the pot size that you have, all plants can curl their roots around, you know, particularly a smooth edge pot. So the roots, you know, ultimately the roots are the engine of the plant, which enhances the nutrient uptake and ensures the stability when they're planted. You know, even small tubes can develop curled roots. The secret is that a quality nursery will root prune as they pot up the plants to every stage. So every time they pot it up, they will root prune. And it might just be a shaving of the edges, but it stimulates the roots to divide. And but if you don't, you'll get a strangled entwined root system, which stunts the growth. So you'll get something that'll survive, but it won't thrive. You have to use every stage of potting up. You have to use good horticultural practices, and there's a few nurseries, or quite a few nurseries, that opt to use the air pots, or what was known as rocket pots, certainly within the industry. You know, these pots were developed in Sydney by the late Peter Lawton and another gentleman, Jamie Single. They developed the system of these pots, wraparound pots that have huge dimples in them. And Jamie and Peter were partners, but Jamie, in his own words, chased and probably shouldn't say this on the radio, but he basically said chased a bit of skirt to Scotland. He met a Scottish girl and ended up marrying a beautiful girl and moved to Scotland. So Peter Lawton and Jamie had an agreement that Peter would do Australia and Jamie would continue in Europe and America and develop it as a separate entity over there, which is what they did. So hence the air pots, something Arborgreen has available and sells, and we have in stock and available to the industry. These pots, the air pots, ensure the root systems develop evenly. They form a dense mass of fibrous root systems. The plants self-prune. So as the roots reach the air through, you know, the masses of dimples, that prevents any root curling occurring.
Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get those circling roots that are really choking each other out with that lateral growth. Instead, the roots are all facing outwards like a hedge.
Absolutely, and in all directions, because even the base. So you get a magnificent root system developed in the air pots, and they still may need root pruning every time you pot them up. And again, that is good. I'll use the same phrase. It's good horticultural practice to do that. But the advantages, I guess, that they offer you a faster growth. You may not need to repot them as often. You know, they can stay in the container, an air pot container, for an extra year if needed. They'll give you a better quality root system, resulting in better ability to take up the nutrients, resulting ultimately in a better plant establishment when you plant out, because they will, and I'll use the phrase again, they'll thrive rather than just survive. The pots are reusable. Yeah, there's been examples even in the US where they've had continued use for 20 years. So it's an investment in that type of system. There's quite a few commercial growers, certainly in Victoria, and they'll be the same in other states, but there's quite a few that use this method and very successfully. But, a quality nursery will just formative prune. They'll root prune at the same time every time they pot up, which gives you the best optimum chance of a plant thriving when planted out.
Yeah, and we won't have to see those plants that are almost treating the ground like it's its own pot just because of the way it's grown. You know, it never realized that it left the pot, so we can avoid that situation without those circling roots.
If planted in the ground with curled roots, it'll just strangle itself. It'll never you'll have a greater risk of it being first decent wind. It won't be able to anchor itself into the ground, and it'll just blow over. And
we've all seen it.
Yes. Yes, indeed. again, as an ex-landscaper before I became a nurseryman, I've seen it. And even back in those days, I learnt that you buy quality. Cheap isn't always cheap.
And so, Bruce, what do you think? I want to go a little bit off script here. What do you think your experience in landscaping has helped you to bring into the nursery game, right? Because I think a lot of people who work in nursery just stay in nursery and they never experience what happens once their plants leave. So what have you learnt in the landscape that you bring to your current role?
I guess I've got the privilege these days as a product advisor, or, I've lived the life. I know, I've just got practical experience from within horticulture itself. I've probably been 40 years, dare I say. I'm giving away my age, but I started my apprenticeship as a landscaper from 15. I love the industry, and I love being a landscaper. I love the creativity. I love quality landscapers are an essential thing. It's I've also equally seen a butcher buying a wheelbarrow and a shovel and call themselves a landscaper. But that's when you'll have the problems of the wrong plant planted in the wrong position, and they'll often go cheap, whereas I've had the benefit of when out practically out there, using good quality stock, good fertilizers, good preparation, good watering techniques, good formative pruning.
In my experience in the landscape, I think I've seen problems that have occurred in the nursery that the landscapers didn't really know was a problem when they planted. And I think having that dialogue between the landscape and the production and the retail, there's a lot of stuff that we're not talking to each other about. And I think you having experience in both sides of it would be really helpful, especially now in your role when you're consulting to people in the industry.
I agree with you, and I've had that opportunity. We have a great opportunity, especially in my role when consulting. We have plenty of landscapers as customers. Mm. So there's too numerous to mention that, opportunities, people come in, landscapers come in, nurserymen come in. And, my role over the years is to be the conduit of knowledge. And I've learned just as much from my own life experience and life as a landscaper and life as a nurseryman and life as a sales rep and a product expert is you know, I've learned more from my customers. And whenever they've had a problem, I pride myself in trying to overcome that problem. And if I don't know the answer, that's fair enough. But I generally know where to seek an answer. And whether it's through the expertise of the nursery industry, the NGIV, themselves, or whether it's often I'll ring other people within the industry and have a chat to them. And, that's something I pride myself in is just being able to be a problem solver and source that knowledge from others and overcome many problems, because the problems usually occurred previously somewhere else. And the great thing is that it is across the board. It's nurserymen, it's landscapers that we're dealing with. And more there's a great synergy between the landscape industry and the nursery industry. They often have combined functions. They often, through Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show, there's a lot of crossed dialogue that occurs and a lot of training opportunities that occur together. And so that's a good thing.
Totally agree. So I think it's like this is what I was talking about with Mark as well just before we jumped on this call, is that your role isn't just like a sales or marketing. Really, you're providing like a consulting service, and that's basically free of charge is the consulting service. People only have to buy the products.
I totally agree with that. And, I agree with the philosophy of Arborgreen is that we are an extension of the businesses that we're servicing. We're there as that point of contact, and it's, I love it. I actually love that side of it. I love coming up with a solution or giving options for a solution. Again, I don't always know the answer myself, but generally speaking, I can find out or assist in finding out to overcome a problem.
So this episode, it's targeted towards people who are either interested in learning about the nursery side of things because they're not in the industry and they just want to have a peek in and see, oh, well, what's going on over in this side? And it's also for people who are setting up their own business or maybe have been in business for a while and just would like to go through the basics again. So this question is a little bit basic, but I'm hoping we can find some nuance here. Can you walk us through the process of propagating trees and getting them ready for sale, including a brief overview of the different propagation methods?
We'll give it a crack. look, propagating plants is a great joy about it. That's something I probably miss from being in the nursery is the propagation side. My role used to be as a nursery manager, used to be going out at 5 o'clock in the morning and taking cuttings and bringing them back to the nursery before the staff got there so that the cuttings were fresh. They were, they weren't stressed at all because they'd been cut early morning with the dew. But it was such a joy in propagation. And even to do it domestically, you get so much satisfaction out of seeing something that you've cut, stuck into a rooting hormone, and you watch it develop a root system. Obviously, it's different from a commercial point of view. But there is a lot of satisfaction and joy with it. There's different types of propagation. And propagation's all about cloning plants. You're trying to get a new plant. If it's from a native point of view, you may very much need to go out and seek seed for different native species. And that could be anywhere between trees, eucalypts through to many wattles, et cetera, even grasses. So there's a big emphasis on collecting seed. And as I mentioned earlier, there is little time capsules where you need to do it when there's seed available. You can't just say, next month I'm going to do it. You've actually got to do it when it's the right time of year to do it. Often seed is, if propagating was seed, there might be an element of local provenance so that you're trying to seek specific species of trees within a local area. So that's a big impact on on that native species side of it. Another form of propagation is tissue culture, which I confess is not my area of expertise, but it is cloning plants and bringing them back and growing them from a very small entity into seedlings, into then go on through the process of potting up. Coming up certainly into the near future would be what we call bare root season. So there's a lot of nurseries out there that specialise in deciduous stock, and they'll grow the plants in ground, but then they'll pull them out and sell them on to other nurseries to then pot up into pots. And, you know, that could be roses, it could be fruit trees, it could be all sorts of ornamentals as well. Grafting is another form of propagation. You know, budding onto rootstock is a very important one. But the most common method used in propagation, you know, certainly for the nursery ornamental section, is probably by cuttings.
It's just simple. Chop off a bit of stem, plug it in.
Yep, absolutely. So,
bit of rooting hormone, maybe.
The propagation window, as I mentioned, doesn't stop for you. You've got to be ready for it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, even if you've got your own stock gardens, it's regularly checking, are they ready? You know, a good cutting should, probably the analogy that I used to use with my staff, is it's got to be like a fresh bean, and we can snap a bean before you eat it. But if it's saggy or if it's, you know, too hard, then you've missed the window. So that sweet spot is snapping like a bean. Then you do need things like hormone powders. Hormone could be powders, it could be hormone gels, it could be hormone liquids. And there's indole butyric acid, the IBA is probably the most common one. And then there's the napathalic acid, so the NAA, I think it is, napathalic acid. The two different types of hormone acting on a plant. You know, obviously you need good quality propagation secateurs. You're going to need perlite, vermiculite. So it's an exciting thing. Some nurseries, you know, they may control a whole life cycle of a plant by maintaining and controlling their own stock gardens. You know, others, as I used to do, used to have to travel miles to know where a particular tree was. So you'd have permission from somebody to go onto their property and cut it back, and that was always a good thing. But you only propagate using healthy, thriving stock to get the cutting material. Others may purchase plants from other nurseries in smaller containers and then pot them up. Mm. And, so they might sort of not even propagate at all, but they'll let somebody else do that. And, you know, and they might not have all the a propagation nursery will generally need fog houses and some certain particular, you know, heated benches. So they might not have that infrastructure and they might not need it. You know, their investment might be, well, let someone else do that and we'll buy mm-hmm. the stock in. When you're potting up, it's usually about a year per pot size. You know, that's probably not so much the propagation side, but it may be, you know, you propagate to get a strut cutting, and then from the strut cutting you pot up into a small pot. Usually might be a 2-inch pot or a 3-inch pot, or sorry, 50 mil or 75 mil pot for the younger folk. And that's the amazing thing about the nursery industry, because most of them still use imperial sort of, they always say 6-inch pots, 10-inch pots, but in reality you learn to converse in both these days. But yes, once you've got it, you've got a strut cutting, that's the exciting thing. You can watch its growth as it goes, gets potted up every year.
So, and you've essentially made money out of nothing, right?
Indeed, a little bit of time, but you can, absolutely, and it's a joy. And I'll keep using that word, but it's an amazing satisfaction to do that.
So now seems like a good time to talk about the nuances between three different terms relating to nursery. Now, you can even, I guess, be all three of these terms, but what does production, wholesale, and retail mean in this context?
Production nurseries can be wholesale nurseries, probably are wholesale nurseries, but production nurseries will generally be propagation nurseries. And there are propagation nurseries, then there's what I would call a general, probably wholesale nursery. But within that, there could be advanced tree nurseries. So it vary, and you can have any of the combinations. Many nurseries I know will, to guarantee their own quality, will start from scratch. They will do the propagation. They will have a finger in every part of the plant. So that way they absolutely guarantee the quality all the way through. Someone like, and I wasn't going to use nursery names, but there's, someone like Mansfield's Nursery are a propagation nursery. So that's what they specialize in. They take the cuttings, they grow it to a small plant, usually a probably a two inch tube, and they'll on sell it to other wholesale nurseries, which will then grow that on to a point and size pot that's appropriate for the retail. So the retail are the end of the line, but there's quite a few nurseries that will, when I think that'll be all of the three. They'll be production nurseries, wholesale nurseries, and they'll have a retail outlet. There are others that will buy, as I said earlier, they will buy pots in of a smaller size to only sell from a 10-inch or 250-mil pot upwards. So they cut out all of that junior stock. They rely on somebody else to do that. So the advanced tree nurseries will often buy in 200-mil pots and grow up from there. So they would be a wholesale nursery selling to a wholesale nursery. Some won't have any retail exposure whatsoever. So it's very varied. And I can, obviously I've had involvement with lots and lots of nurseries, but it's interesting. Certainly the nursery I used, we were a wholesale nursery and a production nursery. So we didn't sell directly to the public. We sold to people then, even Bunnings.
Landscapers.
Yeah, landscapers and to Bunnings and to other big contractors, I guess. And most wholesalers wouldn't sell to the public. They would sell to Bunnings is probably a huge outlet these days. It's just too numerous. But most are production, generally the propagation.
And then you might have like a garden center that has a little cafe in it. They may not do as much production.
No, and they will generally buy in. The nursery industry of Victoria, the NGIV, they have a trade day or market day once a month, usually the first Tuesday of every month. The retailers will come to that and often buy all their stock for the following for the next month. So that's even as a new person coming in and interested into the nursery industry, give the nursery industry of Victoria a ring, get a day pass to come in and just to have a look at the huge variety of different nurseries. There's nurseries that specialize in indoor plants. There's nurseries that specialize in tubes. There's nurseries that specialize in, their own niche. Which is an amazing thing. So there's nurseries that'll be water plants only. There'll be nurseries that are carnivorous plants. It is so varied, and that's part of the excitement of the industry because there's such a variety there. That you can specialise in, and many do in trees. But the variety is immense.
Totally. I mean, that's why we love it, right? That's why we get into this game. And I think
there's also excitement in specializing too. So, you know, if you're really into your carnivorous plants, like just live your dream and just have a, you know, production wholesale nursery just related on producing masses and masses of carnivorous plants. And, or you could, you know, focus on breeding new plants as well. Like that's another exciting area that we won't have time to go into today, but it is very exciting.
Indeed. I agree with you.
So look, there's a bit of a cliche in our industry, right plant, right place. And I think it's a cliche for good reason. What are some of the key factors to consider when you're growing plants on a production scale, or even when you're retailing? Like, what do we need to think about from a nursery perspective in terms of right tree, right place?
From a production point of view, a commercial production point of view, have a crystal ball. look, that is something that'll for an eternity will be the situation. What do I grow? How many do I grow? It's really doing a bit of analysis. What are the trends? You're always aiming to grow what a customer wants. Mm. You do look for new varieties if they're available, because I think that's, you know, from a landscape or a landscape architect point of view, they are keen to have new varieties wherever possible. There's a lot of new innovations with species. You know, how many capital pairs can we have? Whereas there's huge innovations, and the capital pair actually is probably a good example, because that was, yeah, it's an ornamental pear, but it's a slender growing pear. So that's, more and more there's trends for what do you grow? Well, the trends are for narrower spaces. Mm-hmm. So there is probably a trend to cultivate and grow narrower growing varieties, whether it's, you know, in a camellias, which is probably, you know, back in the day, it was my bread and butter. But, you know, these narrower growing camellias that were fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's a big question. It's a great question, because what you're seeking is, you've got to think long term. Because what's propagated now, you know, depending on the species, that might actually be sold for 5 or 6 years. So what you propagate now won't actually hit the garden for that long. So you analyze previous sales. You a lot of nurseries will seek contract growing, so that they grow specifically, which is probably that case when for the larger nurseries, as mentioned, they will say, look, give me 1,000, 8-inch, 200 mil, whatever's, Lagerstromii indicus. What is thought after would be colours. You've got to keep colours in mind. Historically, white remains the most sought after colour. You've got to have a consideration with what you're growing with foliage type, narrow, upright, weeping habits. With smaller gardens being the trend, you've got to consider what's appropriate for pots, balconies, patios, vertical gardens.
So you've really nailed that there. So it's all about knowing your customer, isn't it? So the right tree for the right place depends on where you are and who you're selling to. Like, let's say you're a retail nursery in an inner suburb. Well, a lot of people have small backyards, so it is going to be your compact type trees, if trees. And then, so it's the right tree at the right place really starts with the grower. And I guess also it's about providing that advice to your clients too. Like, if they come in and they're telling you about their needs and then suddenly you realize they've got the wrong plant, well, it's really up to you to have the knowledge to provide that feedback.
Indeed. Another thing to consider, and it's sort of out there, is climate change and choosing climate change species. You know, people are now selecting species from areas that thrive in hotter, drier environments. Wherever possible, you ask what constitutes local provenance. and they'll go to the extreme. So they might actually, you know, if it's a 150-kilometre circle, they'll go 150 kilometres north to select varieties or select seed from plants that are going to cope better in those hot or dry environments, because, you know, there's obviously going to be that ongoing debate, but there's no doubt that it is predicted that Melbourne's climate will eventually be like Burke, or be like, you know, it's we are going to end up with a hotter, drier summers, and there is very much a consensus that we really do need to be looking at choosing species that will thrive in those environments.
Yeah, because yeah, what worked in the past may not necessarily work in the future in a place.
That's right. That's right.
So now let's move on. I'd like to know, like, what are some of your tips for ensuring that you have, like, good quality stock, like trees, shrubs, whatever you're selling? And, like, what are some of the measures that you can take to prevent disease, pests, different outbreaks like that, and just ensure the overall quality of your plants?
I think that the best comment would be to make would be choose plant stock of superior quality to pot up. So don't you pot up rubbish, you're going to have rubbish. You pot up quality and you will remain with quality. So that's an essential ingredient to it all. Maintaining a clean, weed-free and pest-free environment. I think it's essential within a nursery to have regular visual checks of all your stock. I used to sort of used to allocate that up, you know, to staff, and I'd say row A and row B, it's your responsibility. Just grab a coffee in the morning and walk those aisles, walk those rows, and just check that the watering's been on, check that there's not any pest or fungus, you know, issues, visual issues. So it's absolutely imperative that you have a visual check. If you're using recycled water, ensure that it's been treated or filtered. Allow, you know, these are some of the basic things. Allow space between plants for air movement. Because most of the time that there's an issue with fungus, it's usually lack of air movement. Keep plants off direct contact with the soil. You know, I've seen that. I've seen, again, cheap equals cheap. You've got to have good hygiene, good horticultural practices. And, you know, if you have it directly sitting on soil, well, that's the avenue for disease to come up through the soil and into your potting mix. You know, aim for integration pest disease management. So what used to be IPM is now sort of IPDM. Encourage natural predators to thrive. You know, only interviewing when you actually have to. You know, strive for, I'm not an expert on this, but, there's a lot of nurseries using Australian Standard AS2303. That's a pretty important, letters and numbers to recognise. But purchase from growers that meet that standard, because they ensure that all the practices of good horticultural practice are there.
Okay, so you're not going to buy your, you know, Monstera Deliciosa variegated variety from someone off eBay or something like that and then try and on-sell that to your clients?
Absolutely, because you don't know the history. You don't know the soil pathogens. You don't know, whether it is, as we've talked about earlier, root-bound, you know. Having the Australian standard, it was there, developed, and it was there for a reason, to set a standard that across the board everyone should be striving to meet, and that ensures quality.
That's a beautiful thing. So how important is it to have, like, proper staking on your trees, particularly trees we're talking about now? But there are a lot of plants that also use staking. Like, how much money is wasted when people use the wrong staking? You know, if we use the wrong staking, can it harm our plants? Can you tell us about some of the nuances in this space?
Yeah, look, very important to stake plants at a young age, if you use the wrong size stake, it's going to damage your root system. A stake offers support, it offers protection, it helps guide the plant to grow in the right direction with an apex growth. That's what it's there for. It's not there, shouldn't be there forever. And, you know, it's not there to hold it up. It's there to start it. I used to use a term or phrase, never stake through the heart of the root system. So always, rule of thumb was two fingers away from the trunk. Very important to choose a stake appropriate to the pot size and the plant height, whether that's a bamboo stake or a hardwood, pot stake. You've got to be careful of the root system. That's the critical thing. Choose, the other part of the staking is you're putting your stake in, but you've got to choose the right tie for the staking. Whether you use a max tape in a gun with max tape, which is a very efficient way of staking. You may use, as you grow for trees, you may use easy ties, which are a long rubbery tie that's a bit like a snake, but it has little nodules on it. But being the rubber, it allows it to move a little bit. You might just use plant clips, which are a little plastic C clip. Some people call them Pac-Man clips. If you're using standards, if you've got standard sort of trees or standard roses, etc., you might use rubber anchor bands because they will solidly put the stake and the trunk together so that it won't allow it give you that rigidity, but it won't allow it to move. Mm-hmm. Twist ties are occasionally used, but that's probably more in smaller plants. I'll refer back to the AS2303 standard, and a 45 liter container and upwards should aim to be self-supporting without a stake. That's the aim. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't need a stake. Often they will still have a stake there, but it's not there to offer it's not there to be the skeleton or the strength behind it. It's just there to guide that growth.
I've seen it as a maintenance gardener quite a few times, many times actually, where you've got particularly standard roses and they're staked up really tightly. And then my job is to try and remove those stakes because that's what you're supposed to do, but then they just flop over. So I guess that's a nursery problem, is it? Or is that an installation problem, would you say?
From a standard rose point of view, good question. I think ultimately from a production point of view, you need the stakes for a standard rose. They should be self-supporting eventually once the root systems are established in ground. So
I guess they never got the chance because ever since installation, maintenance has always been so tight, so the trees never really had to. It would be like somebody who'd never used their legs before. Their legs are just – there's no strength in them. They can't support the body because they've never been trained.
That's right. And ultimately, that's the aim of when you're planting out. You shouldn't need to be staking and tying plants. They need to be – the aim is to have a decent girth on a tree before it's planted out and self-sufficient in its ability to hold itself up. Mm. And you do need to have give, even if you're tying up a tree when you're planting it out into a garden, or you can still stake it with and tie it, but it needs to be that there's some flex there so that there's some movement there, so that the tree has to force it. The root system, I guess as you said, it gets lazy. A plant gets lazy. If it doesn't have to support itself, well, it won't produce the root system to be able to achieve that. But if it does, if there is a little bit of wind involved, it actually does force the root system to get out there and then support the tree.
There we go. So that starts with good practices in the nursery. We're letting our plants sway in the breeze. When we look over them and we see them all there in uniform rows, they should all be swaying about in the breeze with lots of give, especially on a windy day.
To a point, absolutely.
They shouldn't be flopping over, though.
No, definitely not.
All right, so now I'd like to move on to some of the common pruning mistakes. Like, how can improper or lack of pruning affect the health and growth of plants and trees, and how can we avoid these mistakes, Bruce?
I guess with pruning, timing is everything. You need to be, you know, I've seen this happen. I've seen people prune and then place their pots out into an open growing area, and that once it's pruned, they can be affected. The new growth can be affected by frosts. It can be affected by extreme heat. Mm. So you've got to keep that in mind. You just be aware of that. I think it's essential to maintain your pruning equipment, ensure that it's sharp, ensure that it's sterile. Certainly good practice in my nursery was that you cleaned your secateurs between each batch of plants, just to make sure that if there was some sort of form of fungal disease or something there, that you wouldn't spread to the next batch that you pruned. I was taught you need to prune to an outfacing bud, and I guess a great example of that was one of my original bosses came out late in the afternoon and said, "I'm going to teach you how to prune." And he came out with a bottle of wine and two wine glasses. And I thought, what have we got here? He poured two glasses of lovely red wine and he said, "This is how we prune." And ultimately he said, "Right, now that you've enjoyed your first sip of red wine, look at the wine glass. And that is how we're going to prune." So he
wise. Like a goblet shape.
A goblet shape, and pointing all the buds pointing on an outward direction. Any inward growth crossing into the center of the plant was he said, "No, get rid of that. But you want remind yourself every time you prune to have a glass of wine, and that's the secret of life."
Yeah, and there's also an analogy in there as well of taking it slow and enjoying yourself when you're doing formative pruning, because it can be a very tactile, enjoyable part of gardening. It's one of my favourite tasks.
I tend to agree. I love pruning. I love pruning roses. Mm-hmm. These days I'm happy to prune my neighbour's roses, and I end up with a glass of wine anyway, so that's a good thing. from a practical point of view, you avoid making flush cuts. You know, you leave a bit of a collar there, and it can sometimes just be millimetres in it, but equally you don't leave it too long. So you don't want to cut into the main trunk too much. Look, horticulture is all about observation. You know, learn from your successes, and you learn just as much from your mistakes. So that if you have cut something back too hard and you see that die back occurring, you know, that's something you can learn from and, alter it next time you do it.
Well said. So a regular guest of the show, consulting arborist Gary Moran, loves ARS brand pruners. He's told me this specifically on a couple of times. I know that you guys sell them at Arborgreen. Can you tell me, like, why do people like ARS pruners specifically, I guess compared with the pair of cheap pruners, but even compared to other brands that are out there, like, why are ARS so good?
Generally speaking, I'm going to compare to start with the cheapies. As always, you know, I can imagine my grandfather sitting on my shoulder right now, and he'd tell me, "Buy it right the first time, and you buy it only once."
Yeah.
And you know, and the other thing on the other shoulder, he'd be saying, "Use the right tool for the right job." Mm-hmm. And that's the secret, really. You know, if you're struggling with a pair of secateurs, put them down and use a pair of loppers. If you're struggling with a pair of loppers, put them down and use a saw. But to put it bluntly, cheapies won't last. They certainly won't maintain their sharpness and the precise cutting ability. You know, because they won't hold together. The two blades won't meet precisely, so they will bruise and they'll tear at the plant tissue, which increases the chance of disease entry. the cheapies will warp quickly and they'll put more, you know, equally, they'll put more stress and fatigue on the hands. So ARS and Falco, but ARS they're both quality tools that offer strength, sharpness, reliability, you know, and which will last a lifetime. They're both, you know, the ARS and the Falco, they've got availability of spare parts if required. You know, the Secateurs themselves, just the ARS are well made. They're absolutely legendary for their sharpness. I can attest that when taking cuttings, you know, I mentioned earlier about going up early at 5:30 in the morning and taking cuttings. Well, when you're bunching up camellia cuttings in one hand and you're still taking cuttings, I learnt the hard way that keep your fingers out of the way, because I put a lovely little nick in my left hand as I cut the foliage, and wasn't the only thing I cut. So, but at least with the ARS Secateurs, they're so sharp, and that it just did a very, very neat wound. So healed very quickly. look, ARS, I'm a huge rap for. Even head shears, the go-to head shears, and once you've had them, you'll never go back, is the ARS K1000. Very sharp, very long, elongated, fairly lightweight compared to other head shears, but very precise. So a lot of nurseries will buy those and then rebuy them. You have, and buy them as gifts for others, because they're a good thing. The most common sought-after propagation secateur within the whole of Australian industry is the ARS 300L. They're used because they're very sharp, they're strong, they're lightweight, and most importantly, they're light on the spring tension, which is a big thing. Because if you're propagating all day, every day, they just don't fatigue the hand like other secateurs do. So, a good pair of secateurs is, you've got to keep that in mind. It's it's got to be light enough, strong enough, but light enough on the hand that you don't get that RSI type of injury if you're doing it lots and lots. Probably not as important if you're doing it domestically, but always use clean and sharp tools, and ARS offers that sharpness and just that quality that'll be lifetime.
So I guess, look, if it was just that you looked more professional coming in with a nice pair of secateurs, that's one thing. If it was just that it would make your work easier, that's another thing. If it was just that, buy once. These are all really good reasons to speak on like buying quality tools, but it's actually more than just those things. It's also that you're going to harm your plant if you use the wrong secateurs, because you're going to cause tears and bruises, as you said. You're going to cause damage to yourself. So we cannot urge this enough. People should be buying quality tools. If you're in this trade, you need to buy quality tools. Don't be you're not a home gardener. You're actually a professional, and you should buy the tools accordingly.
And I use the word last a lifetime. Well, I've had secateurs for 30 years. Now, I may have over that period changed the blades over, which the great thing about an ARS and a Falco is that you can do that. But they will last, and they absolutely will last that long. And it is almost a badge of honour to have a pair of secateurs that might have lost some of the rubber on the handle because they've worn through, but they will last a lifetime if looked after.
Okay, so now we've formatively pruned our plants, they're potted up correctly in an air pot, they're, well-maintained, they're fertilised, they're watered, they're looking great. What do we need to do now before they go to sale? Like, is there anything else we need to think about? Do we need to prepare them in any way before they're ready to go on the showroom floor? Do they live on the showroom floor? Do all nurseries prepare plants the same way? This question is getting quite complex. But, like, what do we need to do before plants are ready for sale?
Well, it's all about presentation. So if I was to sell the most quality nurseries, if they were to sell a plant, even if it's going to another wholesale nursery, they will ensure that it's weed-free. pretty basic, but not all nurseries do it, you know, because there's nothing worse than having a reputation of selling some plants with flickweed seed in it and having a batch come through. Most nurseries will scrape around the top and remove any obvious weeds, but it's pretty evident that if you're selling on pots, you've got to have them clean, because you might put all the energy into having a clean environment yourself, but often the weeds that come in are from somebody else's nursery, not yours. But so you have a weed-free pot. You have clean pots. You make sure, you know, before you're ready to sort of move your pots on, whether you're selling them, is prune out any faults. That should already be done, to be fair, but if there's any broken branches or twigs or anything like that, remove any dead flowers. Place the label facing out and at a consistent, at the right height, at sort of eye level if possible, if it was for a tree. You know, choose consistent sizing of plants so that they all look the same. I'll refer back to that AS2303 standard. There's actually a size index within that standard, which calculates the required minimum trunk caliper size compared to the height of the tree. So they should all meet that. So that when there's nothing worse than having, if you've got six trees and four of them are 1.8 meters tall, and then two of them are 2 meters tall, they should all be the same. So I think that's the secret. It is pretty basic, but you'd be amazed at how many people don't take that advice and just do the right thing.
Yeah, well said. So I think something that's important as well is, like, when you're looking at trees every day, they don't look the same to you as they do to somebody who's walking in for the first time, if that makes sense. So, like, you mentioned, like, pulling out all the dead flowers and stuff like that. Like, I can imagine someone who's working with this plant every day, who's seen the flowers bud up, then go through its full stage into the fruiting phase, and then the flowers are dead. It may not look unsightly to them. So just look away for a second, refresh your brain, hit the refresh button, and then look back again at the plants and try and look from a fresh perspective. Try and view from how your customers see them.
Oh, I think that's important. If I was presenting a plant, it is how would I like it to have it received? How would I like to receive it?
Yeah.
And that's how I would traditionally try and sell a plant. So I want it to be neat. I want it to be all of those things as mentioned before. I think that's the secret, is what would I be prepared to accept as quality?
That's a great point. That really says it all.
Yeah.
So is there a way to determine the optimal time to sell particular plants? Like, especially, like, when, how do we know when to prepare for what plants? Like, is this, like, do we sell the same trees at all times throughout the year, or what's going on in terms of planning when to sell what?
That's a huge question. I think the best time to sell and the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago.
Yes.
Look, ultimately, you, from a commercial point of view, you document the history of previous sales, but ultimately the plants are consistently sold throughout the year. There's no particular time that they're not. And so sales are usually dictated by when the plants are ready, but more importantly, when the customer actually wants them. And that can be so abstract.
So get poinsettias ready for Christmas.
Yes. And, certainly there is more sales when things are in flower. So that's the ultimate time that you've got to have things ready is, from my background with camellias, well, when the camellias were in flower, that's when you sold the most of them. So, but you've got to ensure that this is, you know, when you're selling them, you know, the optimal time is when the plant's ready too. So ensure that the substantial root system has been established after potting up prior to selling, because you can pot up into a next size pot, but you can't sell it until that, that root system has established throughout that, that, that pot structure. Mm-hmm. You know, the other obvious timing examples are, you know, presenting plants so to display at the optimum, you know, vibrant autumn colour, perhaps, or when flowers, as I mentioned, is when flowers, when the plants are flowering or in bud. You know, I used to always aim, you know, the big one was always to aim to sell the plants before they reach their peak, in display wise. So, you know, just sell them as they were budding, if they were full of bud, so that if they went into a retail situation, they would have longevity of display. So yes, you are from that point of view, you are timing your optimum sales to match its best display option.
Hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of thought that goes into that. There's not really a silver bullet there, is it? It's or other than the flowers, that's probably a pretty good silver bullet. If it's in flower, it's going to sell at that time. So get them in front of customers then. But certainly something to think about. When are you going to get what in front of who?
Yes, and that's a hard question to ask. To ask and perhaps to answer.
Yeah. Easy to ask. It was very easy for me to ask it. And I think a lot of people are asking that question, and so there's not an easy answer. It's about understanding you're going back through your books, understanding who's buying from you, understanding who you want to target, understanding previous trends.
Yes. And look, very much so. And more, commercial nurseries are seeking contracts with other nurseries so that they know that there is a timing. Some of the commercial nurseries will have commitments with Bunnings and other retail stores to have spring offers or have so they have a timing to try and aim at. Wherever possible. And you know, it's easier with species such as Pittostrums, where they're very quick growing, so that you can take it back in time from when there's a spring catalogue due. You can take it back, you know, and do the calculations and take it back. All right, I might need 5,000 Pittostrums ready. And that helps a nursery with the numbers that they propagate as well. So that's important.
And I think landscape designers and landscape architects sometimes rub up production nurseries and retail nurseries the wrong way a little bit sometimes when they say something like, hey, can I have 5,000 of such and such 10-year growth tree tomorrow, please?
So it is, as I've mentioned previously, a tree, you can't just snap your fingers. There's a process there, and it might be a 5-6+ year process before a tree is ready. So that a lot of forward thinking, and that's where the good landscape architects will approach a nursery to say, yeah, in a few years' time, can I have this many plants? Mm-hmm. And then it's achievable. But it's not as achievable when you just snap your fingers and say, yeah, I need these now. Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. So what about innovative new technologies that are disrupting the nursery space? Like, okay, obviously we've got a lot of automation, we've got a lot of new products. Can you tell us what's going on in terms of new technologies in the space?
Probably the biggest one that I've seen, especially with tree nurseries, is a much better improvement in manual handling. So I'm speaking from my own experience with a bad back, which was, I sort of mentioned earlier that strong of muscle, but not always strong of head. There wasn't a lot of knowledge or training in occupational health and safety practices when I started my apprenticeship as a landscape gardener. You know, there was no earmuffs, there was no knee pads, there was no You know, as a 15-year-old lifting huge ironbark sleepers over my shoulder and marching around, and I could do it, but ultimately that was the cause of a bad back. So I'm very pleased that these days, and even when I was the manager of my nursery, I absolutely preached safety of your back, safety of your body, and manual handling has come a long way. So, you know, with big trees come, you know, big pots, which comes a big weight. So, you know, these days there's the main one that I've seen introduced over the last few years is forklift pot tines, I should say. And so a forklift does that for you. And they'll come along, and with the lips of the pots, they sort of come along and they pick up, it literally might be 30, 40 plants at a time, and move them from one spot to another. And that's made a huge difference. Even the innovation, hand trolleys specifically for some of the bigger pots. You know, there has been innovation in potting machines and the conveyor belts, and you know, there's low loader trailers to prevent you from, you know, there's a lot of sliding of pots rather than lifting of pots. Other innovations, I think, within a nursery setting is the use of drones. And, you know, I've seen a nurseryman sit there with a beer after work with a drone and just inspecting the rows of plants by going up and down with the drone. You know, remote cameras, remote sensors, new innovation, you know, it's been good to see that there's an emphasis on biodegradable. So I talked about Max Tape earlier, and you know, that is the stock standard for the nurseries, the majority for tying, but there is a biodegradable Max Tape these days that we sell, and that's gaining momentum, because if it does drop on the ground, it's going to rot down, you know, from a cornstarch or a plant type material, whereas I can guarantee you, every wholesale nursery that you walk around, you look on the ground and you'll see little snippets of plastic everywhere, and so that to me is a great innovation. There's been a lot of improvements in irrigation techniques and better innovation in drippers, which means less nutrients being washed through your potting mix and back on out into the ground. So there's a lot of exciting things happening within the nursery industry with innovation. And most nurserymen and nursery people, not men, but nursery people, are quite open to try new things. There's, you know, not so much from a tree production point of view, but, you know, there's a lot of innovation with lighting. For smaller propagating plants, which is a good thing. And that's optimizing the growth of plants as well.
Can you walk us through what successful nurseries are doing with their irrigation? Like, is it all hand watering? What's going on there?
It is, it's both. Most of it is hand watering where needed. And a lot of the nursery industry uses dram products, so dram water, what they call water breakers, and they come in different sizes. That so you're not blasting the soil out of your pots. So there's soft. There's a little bit of science behind it. There's the more holes that you have in a water breaker, the softer the water. So for small tubes, etc., you'd use a 1,000-hole water breaker, but the majority of the nurseries use a 400-hole water breaker or water rose. It's called many things. The technical term is water breaker. But yeah, tips for managing irrigation and fertilization is ensure someone physically inspects the stock. Yeah, plants don't take a holiday, so they're a living beast. You know, from my own, I had a very hard experience as a young nursery manager. I checked on the Friday afternoon, I checked every single sprinkler head on the property. Very confidently went away for an Australia Day weekend. However, I went bushwalking, which was great. That was when I was young and fit and proud to take my shirt off. I can't do that these days. came back after 3 days of 40-plus degree heat to a whole section of the nursery had perished. And despite checking every sprinkler head, rats had eaten through the solenoid wires on one area. Mm. And, I lost a lot of plants. So that was a hard lesson from irrigation is, and it never happened again, that on every single day that there may have been extreme heat, either myself or somebody else that was nominated would go to the nursery and check. It used to take me 10 minutes to walk around the nursery, but that was well and truly worth the time to guarantee that the stock was safe, because you just have to do it. So you always have somebody to go and do that. So that's the biggest advice I can give any young nurseryman is just take the time. And whether that's Christmas Day, you know, New Year's Day, you still have to do it. And that's something else that I think the general public don't realise, is that plants are there every day of the year. So you've got to protect them every day of the year. Look, some nurseries utilise the Bureau of Meteorology these days. You know, they efficiently analyse the moisture levels within their immediate environment, and they automatically adjust the irrigation to suit, or irrigation needs to suit. Long-term pots may need top dress fertilizer. They may also benefit from applying a soil wetter to reverse any hydrophobic potting mixes. So whether that's a liquid sea-sole soil wetter, or ICL have a product, or there's also a saturate, is a granular form. That I think is an essential thing for long-term pots. Yeah, even I'm a big advocate for sea salt. So applying sea salt at the stage when you fertilise, even in the ground. So if I'm not just pots, but if I was planting a plant out, I would soak a plant, the root ball of the plant, in a rubbish bin full of sea salt and water, and this assists in stimulating the root system and enhancing the uptake of any fertilizer applied. Many of the commercial nurseries will opt for using the sea salt plus iron because it adds that little bit of greening aspect to it. You try and keep the watering and the irrigation to a minimum, because you want to toughen them up. You don't want them, if you're watering and make them too soft, well, you'll have soft growth.
Yeah, and they'll die when they get to the customer's place. Yeah, and they'll exactly wonder, you sold me a dud.
Yeah, and that's exactly the scenario, is that you want to produce a tough plant. So it's a little bit of tough love. You want to just have it, and it is a fine line, and a good nurseryman can find that balance.
And I guess it comes down to having the right potting mix and having the right pot as well, right? So there's no point in having something really heavy, really just straight compost or something in a bottomless pot that doesn't have a hole in the bottom. I mean, doesn't matter what you do with that plant, it's never going to survive for most plants.
That's right. And look, good potting mixes have that good air porosity and the we talk about the air pot, and that helps produce that great structure of root system. And it's just maximising when it does get planted, it's going to thrive, not just survive.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what your irrigation system is if you don't have the right potting medium. And that's another topic for another day. We're not really going to get a chance to talk about that today. I mean, we can't cover everything in one episode. But I would like to just quickly touch on fertilising if possible. Like, what do successful companies do in terms of fertilisation?
From a commercial point of view, often they'll use Osmocote is probably the most common one sought after. with a balanced NPK. Certainly a retail point of view, there is some marketing involved, but most of the nurseries will use a general purpose Osmocote with a balanced NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium. Obviously for native plants, they'll go that native blend, so a low phosphorus. All plants love a little bit of phosphorus, but it's and I guess that's probably the misconception from most people, is they think it's a native plant and say you don't have any phosphorus, but it's really only the grevilleas and the banksias of this world that are, you know, more specifically need that finesse of you know, low phosphorus, but most natives actually like and enhance a little bit of phosphorus.
It's a funny myth. How did this get out? You're right, it's the Proteaceae members, and yes, there's a few others as well, but this idea that all natives need a special fertilizer, no, not necessarily true. Like a lot of our Myrtaceae members love a bit of phosphorus.
They do. So it is only that Proteaceae, you know, Hardenbergius is probably another one that may be low, need low P, but yeah, there is a myth that I think we have to strive to reset.
Yeah. So I guess that's it then. So would you use is it viable to use organic fertilizers in an average nursery, or do you really have to niche down and actually call yourself an organic nursery if you're going to go down that route?
Look, I guess there's a little bit of experimentation. The most efficient way to fertilise is to use a controlled-release fertiliser in a commercial setting. If it's in the ground, that's different. There's a lot of people in ground would use still a controlled-release fertiliser, but it's a Tro-Forte, which I'm a big advocate for, in the ground, because that the Tro-Forte adds it's got minerals and microbes added to the fert, so that enhances, you know, that organic aspect, enriching aspect in ground. I also like organic ferts. Again, not so much in pot, but in ground, I think it's because that adds to the humic acid and the builds up the compost side of your garden. But in pots themselves, from a commercial scale, it very much so is the Osmocote of this world, the Nutricotes, the Macrocotes, it's because it's so precise and it's so reliable that a nursery will absolutely go that way.
I notice as well, like I grow my own veggies in pots at home in grow bags, and the colour of the water, like I put a lot of organic fertiliser in it because it's not a money-saving thing for me. I just put organic fertiliser in it. And every time I watch that brown water coming out the bottom, it does make me feel a little bit sad because I know that those are nutrients just leaching out of the pot that are going down the drain. You know, they're going into – luckily, the way I've directed it, they sort of usually get directed into the hedge, so it's not getting lost. But in a nursery setting, they'd be going down the drain, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's money.
And that's money. And I guess a good quality controlled-release fertilizer, it won't dump. It is there, and that's where it becomes so precise. If you want an 8 to 9 month release, you you're pretty confident that you're going to get that 8 to 9 month release. Whereas organic fertilizers, they have a benefit, whether it's blood and bone, whether it's AgriBoost, which is commercial blending or commercial badging of Dynamic Lifter. Plenty of nurseries will use sudden impact for roses, and they'll often use those on magnolias, not just roses. So they're used, but generally as a whole, the majority of the nurseries through all different sized plants need that reliability of release.
The reliability, because you've got enough things to think about. You cannot monitor every single plant in your stock.
Yes, and they also, you know, if you're using an organic fert, you may need to apply that more often. So it's also a cost-saving mechanism by having something that will lease over that period rather than having to go back, use the labour to reapply.
Okay, so we're saving money where we can. You know, we shouldn't be wasting money on silly things where it's just money down the drain. We should be saving up that money to buy better quality products, better quality stock. Do you have any advice for people revolving around, you know, investing in high quality stock, or, you know, where can they spend the money and where should they try and save it?
Ultimately, I'll use a phrase which will probably cover it all. Quality talks, quality over quantity. The long cut is the shortcut. You know, I can bring out more cliches. It's you buy quality, and at least you are optimizing that chance for that plant to thrive when you plant it out. So you are better investing in a higher quality plant. You know, certainly even when I was landscaping, I'd always say to a customer, what's your budget? But be prepared within that budget to spend, you know, three times the amount on one or two plants. And because that's, you know, that's probably a common mistake I see in domestic landscapes that people are doing themselves. They'll go out and they'll buy 6-inch plants, 140 or 150 mil plants, and including silver birch or you know, brachycombs or whatever it is, but they will buy all the same size plant, and it'll never come, that garden will never come to fruition. So you buy plants to scale. Be prepared to pay more to get a quality plant and get it to scale within a landscape setting. You buy those layers of plants so that you, yeah, it's almost, it doesn't have to be instantaneous, but that balance is there in an instant way. I think it's probably good advice for anyone planting out their own garden. And I've said before, but I just believe in the philosophy that, you know, a quality professional nursery, you know, they will grow a plant to have it thrive when it's planted, not when it's sold.
That's such a great point.
It's, you know, they want it to, quality nurseries, those that are using the Australian standards, they will, you know, guarantee that it will thrive when it's planted.
Okay, so what about environmental sustainability in tree production? Like, this is something that's on everyone's mind at the moment. Everyone I'm talking to is really concerned with environmental you know, environmental actions that they can partake in. We don't necessarily all agree, but we're all on the same page in terms of that we want to promote these values. So what can Arborgreen help with this? Like, how can Arborgreen help us with this? And, you know, what can people be doing when they're running nurseries in terms of improving sustainability practices?
I think most nursery and nursery people are environmentally focused. You know, from my own experience and my own interactions, they are well aware of that environmental side, which I'm proud to be part of, the environmental sort of sustainability side. You know, certainly at Arborgreen, this is the other side of our business, which is, you know, tree guards, erosion control, and that's very much part of our ethos and our philosophy is what is the best thing for the environment. The nursery side is, yeah, look, we talked about it before. There's a lot of use of introduction of biodegradable max tape that Arborgreen sell. You know, we've talked about the air pots and the fact that they're a reusable product and it's all made from recycled materials. The tree coach is when you're planting, you know, when you're planting your plants out in the gardens and in open space, the tree coaches are made out of all recycled material. So more and more people are seeking that circle of recyclability, and whether that's the tree guards themselves or the tree coach, it can all be recycled back into, the PP5 plastic recycling scheme. which has been a brilliant thing. And I encourage anyone to participate in this. There's depots where you can drop your pots off. And as long as it's a PP5, which the majority of plastic pots are, it'll be munched up and made back into other pots, which is a great thing. You know, I would encourage all nurseries to use the IPM practices, the integrated pest and disease management, so which means less chemical use, and also means you're encouraging the natural predators. Your ladybirds and et cetera to inhabit your nursery. A lot of nurseries will create garden beds that attract those types of plants. So the garden beds aren't just stock gardens, but they're actually there to try and attract your ladybirds into your environment. Mm,
companion planting.
Companion planting, yes. Yeah. Yeah, look, these things that people could use would be organic options rather than using Comfidor or the, you'd use Azomax, which is an organic option. Slasher is a, rather than using glyphosate, you may use slasher in certain circumstances. Won't slasher is fantastic on annual plants, but may not work as well on perennial plants. It'll burn them back, but that's where you still, I think, still, personally, and this is controversial, but I think there is still a need for glyphosate if used to label, if used, to specification. Glyphosate is still very much the best product to use.
I agree, especially with anything with a taproot. It is controversial, and I have felt the controversy of that, but I do share that opinion. It's about limiting it. It's not about removing it, I think.
Most nurseries are just spot spraying. It's got glyphosate's got a bad rap, but it is the most efficient and most affordable chemical to use. It does dissipate into the soil, it allegedly doesn't remain in the soil, but you can probably cut that bit out. But I'm an advocate for use of glyphosate.
No, I'm not going to cut it out because that is what it says on the label, and that's what it's been tested to. Even there's a bioaquatic glyphosate as well that's supposed to be used around waterways and stuff like that. Like, you should never spray it into the water, and you should really be clever. Obviously, we need to be doing all of that. But, yeah, the more tools we have in our arsenal, the more equipped we are to deal with the pressures of being a professional within this industry.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Most nurseries recycle their water, which is a great thing, and that's really from when you're setting up. If you set up well, you will have the drainage in place to catch all your water. And a lot of nurseries will harvest the water off the top of their igloos and off the top of their roofs, etc. So that's a good thing. Recycling of green waste, I think it's increasingly a part of a nursery. Seeking EcoHort accreditation. We've already talked about the Australian standards, but this is along the same lines but slightly different, is EcoHort accreditation, which is really just sound environmental stewardship. It's striving for continual improvement. You get accredited and audited, so it makes you accountable. I think that's a good thing. A lot of nurseries are investing in and using solar panels these days. That's something I've seen increase over several years. From an environmental sustainability point of view, I guess, the last thing is don't over-fertilise. Keep it on the lean side so as to minimum the nutrients in the waterways. I think it's also another good practice.
So, Bruce, what advice would you give to someone who's, just starting out their career, maybe they're interested in getting into the nursery game, particularly for someone who's looking to start their own nursery? But it must be feeling overwhelming to just try and jump into it. Like, what advice do you have for someone who's just in those initial planning stages?
Give it a crack.
Just go for it.
Go for it. Look, pre-planning, research, research, and research. So, find your spot or consider what your spot is going to be in the market. Mm. What's your niche going to be? What sort of nursery are you aiming to be? Is it a propagation nursery, and what infrastructure do you need to set up that propagation? Is it a general purpose sort of wholesale nursery? Is it advanced tree nursery? Is it a particular type of tree that you're going to specialise in? Are you going to do indoor plants only? Is it going to be succulents? So you could just decide what your passion is, and sometimes it's driven by what your passion is as to what you do. But do the research. Seek that knowledge. Seek the training. Seek advice for the best practice. Join the nursery and garden industry of Victoria, if it's in Victoria, and every other state has their own equivalent. In Victoria, we have a Tree and Shrub Growers Association, and I learned a lot as a young nursery manager going onto the tree and shrubbies, as we sort of call it, and we'd have visits every month to other nurseries. So you have that opportunity to see what the quality nurseries are doing. And I learned a lot just from doing that. Mm. Through the NGIV, you'd be able to seek out what the standards are, what's the best practice, EcoHort, which will guide you in your hygiene practices, your water supply, your recycling, your all of those things. So there's a lot to consider, but if you've got a passion, embrace it and seek it out. Give it a go.
Great advice. Now, Bruce, this has already become quite a long episode, and I want to revel in it. So we're just going to really embrace the long episode. And listeners, if you're listening, I think you're going to enjoy this one, because I can't cut this question out, especially since you teased you had such a good response to it. Bruce, can you share any success stories or memorable experiences from your time in the industry?
Look, the main one is I've always admired the camaraderie and the genuine support from others within the nursery industry. As a young nursery manager at one point, too many years ago now, but many of which may have been your opposition, but they will, and they always have been, the first to offer their assistance and advice. That camaraderie and that honesty and that it's there within the industry. It is something that is very special to our industry, and it's often been commented upon with admiration from others looking in to into our industry from other industries. And it is something that's genuine and something that's very special. As I mentioned earlier, and I think there's, the other great thing is that I've had the privilege to have been able to soak up the knowledge learnt from many, and have been able to act really as a conduit to become a trusted advisor, which is certainly something that Arborgreen strives to be, is that trusted advisor. But, I've been able to share that knowledge with others, and many times being able to be the conduit for solving many problems. And that's really through not in reinventing the wheel. That's through seeking advice from others through their own experiences of already solved that problem over the many years.
Yeah. So I guess no person in this is an island, are they? You really cannot do this by yourself. Like, as smart as you are, as capable as you are, you're always going to need the wider industry and, those connections that we build over time.
That's right. Absolutely right.
So how do you see the nursery industry changing in the coming years? Like, do you see, like, is it going to be people who are doing the same thing? Is it just the trends that change? Is the way that we operate a commercial business going to change entirely? What are your thoughts around that?
I think there's always going to be a need for plants. Mm. Always. you know, I know that I get stress relief from being in my own garden. I love it, and many people do. So there's always, despite what size garden you have, whether it's just indoor plants, you there's a relaxation aspect to it. How is the industry going to change? It's not going to change dramatically, but yeah, I think there is always going to be employment opportunities for young apprentices and workers within the horticulture and industries. Changes in coming years, I think there'll be chemical advancements, and there always has been tweaks on that. I think there'll be more automation and, you know, to seek ways, or they are seeking ways, to minimise the times that you actually pick up a plant. You know, if you go to Holland or somewhere like that, Amsterdam, most of the plants are all with robots, which is incredible. Mm. Not so much trees. It's more the smaller flowers and the smaller stock, but rarely gets touched by a human being.
It's crazy, isn't it? What a wild world we live in.
Oh, indeed. I guess I sort of wrote down a couple of points here that I don't know what the future will hold, but, you know, will the growing media change? Will it become more organic, more sustainable? You know, the future of fossil fuels and the fuel shortages, you know, will that have an impact on fertilizers and chemicals in the future? I don't know. I don't know the answers to that, but you know, there has been changes over years. There's been more coir involved, which is a natural product.
Less peat, I suppose.
Yes, definitely less. You know, and that's where there has been a historical slow change. Less peat, which is not sustainable, and coir, which is a coconut-based product. Don't always like the way that it's produced in third world countries, but that's probably a personal issue than anything else. Mm.
We also do have to address the fact that it is also an inferior product compared to peat. I mean, yeah, okay, peat's unsustainable, so we can't grow it, but you do have to acknowledge that peat is a superior product, and peat is just awesome. So there's a gap there for anyone who can replace peat.
That's right. Absolutely. How do I see the nursery industry changing in coming years? I think there's not going to be huge advancements. It'll always be there. There's always going to be a need for it to be there. There's a push, definite better education of young children, to be more environmentally conscious, to plant more, which I'm huge encouragement for. The proof is, you know, functions like the Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show, you know, some of the best numbers ever this year compared to previous years. So
100,000 people.
There's a need for it to be there. And there's a need for the industry to be there. And, yeah, it's a privilege to be part of that industry.
I completely agree. I think, you know, the automation thing might scare some people away from having a career in the industry, but I think, no, you don't see it right. This is an opportunity. You need to get in now and learn the technology and become the person who knows the technology, because it's a fast moving world, and you know, you shouldn't think that that this industry is going to go away just because there's automation. No, this industry is not going away. This industry is becoming much, much larger.
Oh, very much so. And it's incredibly diverse.
So diverse. We've touched on some of it, even just in the plants that you grow, let alone where you're growing it, let alone different circumstances, locations, microclimates, so much diversity.
Yep.
So much to be excited about. So what about profitability? I've got just two more questions for you. How can we increase the profitability of a nursery business? Like, is there anything we haven't touched on yet that can increase the profitability and the longevity, which in turn increases the sustainability, the economic sustainability of a business?
I think we've covered most of it, but really it's efficiency. It's minimising the handling of individual plants. And as mentioned, people have bought in now with the forklift tines to lift plants. It's minimising, be conscious of minimising your wastage, because often it's the plants you throw out that's your profit. It's not so much the plants you grow, it's the plants you throw out. Yeah. So doing that analysis, do I pot too much up? Do I, there's a lot of that. Mechanisation, we've talked about, potting machines, more efficiency. I'm probably doubling up there. A big one for me is within the first sentence, I think, of our chat today was genuine pricing. I think people just underestimate what a plant costs.
Yeah. I know my wife does every time we go to the nursery. and me too. I have to admit, me too.
Absolutely. But I think generally a lot of nurseries understate the actual cost of a plant. So
no wonder the retail prices are, what they are. It's because we undervalue what has actually gone into this plant. It's not just a little, it's not like a weed that just grows wherever it wants. This is a cultivated plant produced by professionals in a facility that has astounding costs.
And has had input of potting mix, has input of a pot, has had input of fertilizer, has had input of water, labor.
Taking up space.
Absolutely. So all that has to be factored in. And I think pricing, it's not that I want to be saying it too loudly across the board, but pricing, needs to go up on many occasions.
Yeah. And so do wages too.
Indeed. Well, wages have gone up. Wages have gone up, but the cost of a plant hasn't. Fertilizer costs have gone up, but the pricing of a plant hasn't. Mm. So, there's a lot of aspects there. The only important thing, I think, to increase profitability is invest in your staff, invest in training. Invest in the time as well. It's, sometimes a good manager needs to work on the business, not in the business. Mm-hmm. Ensure ultimately quality sells quality. So ensure the consistency of quality.
So, Bruce, we've come to the end of the episode, and there's always one final question I'd like to ask guests. It doesn't have to be on topic. It can be about anything in the world. You can advocate for a change in the world. You can state an opinion. You can plug a product or a service. Is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know about?
Well, look, ultimately, I think it's exciting times ahead for Arborgreen. Through the merger of Arborgreen and Shawgrove Treemax, we've been able to harness a wealth of knowledge within a combined, I believe it's 77 years of business. We proudly say we are a trusted advisor to the industry. We want to be that extra part of our customers' thought pattern to say we're part of their business. We're part of assisting them with problems. The shared synergies of both of our companies, the Shawgrove Treemax and the Arborgreen, have always been at the forefront with an environmental and customer service ethos, which is just something I believe in, and it's a great thing to be part of. We've always been very proactive in seeking out new products and improving old ones. And, we ourselves are always at the front of innovation where possible. It's amazing now to think that we are, almost a national company. We've got offices and warehouses in Mount Barker and Adelaide, or just out of Adelaide. Here in Melbourne, where I'm talking from at the moment, in Brayside and Wetherill Park in Sydney. That just gives us a great footprint for servicing our customers. I'm always full of cliches, but one that I've always liked and I think it's true to finish up on is, we're big enough to cope but small enough to care.
And that is a cliche, but it's true.
Customers are very much, we're in this together. when they literally grow, so do we. So, that's probably a good way to finish up.
Well, what you're saying, it is a cliche, but it's also true because when you succeed, well, when they succeed, they end up buying more of your product. Absolutely. So you're really in synergy together.
Yep, that's right.
Thanks so much for a great episode. I really appreciate your time, Bruce. Great chat, mate.
Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate it. Cheers.
If Bruce sounds like the type of person who you'd like to do business with, check out the show notes, where you'll find links to Arborgreen's social media and their contact page. Arborgreen help nursery and landscape industry businesses every day by providing advice, and they even sell a massive range of quality products if there's a good fit for you. Check out episode 154 with Mark Jarvis about some of the innovations that they are a part of within the industry, including modern tree planting solutions, an unreasonable level of customer service, and a vision for going single-use plastic-free. Also look forward to my chat in a few weeks with another Arborgreen rep, Sam Dalton, about his own speciality of native revegetation,